Welcome back to the Creator Spotlight Podcast. My guest today is Ernie Smith, a writer perhaps best known these days for his long-form newsletter, Tedium, which he's been running since 2015. Tedium is a near decade-old newsletter covering, I quote you, the boring side of the internet. For example, back in 2016, you wrote 1,800 words about the invention of cheese curls. And today you have, I think, around 12,000 subscribers. You send it out, I believe, thrice a week. Before we get into it, did I miss anything within all that?
I've been kind of shaking up a little bit. Sometimes it's three times a week nowadays. I'm doing less longer form stuff with the newsletter. I'm still doing a long form piece every week, but I'm doing a couple of shorter pieces. It's just for sake of sanity, I guess.
Yeah, the sanity bit is hard. We'll get into that a little later when we talk about mid-range, I think. But one of the pieces you shared with me before this that I really liked is from 2020, and you were decrying the loss of the freedom to customize our spaces online. And so I'm going to read a paragraph from near the end that I think sums up the thesis really well. So you said, "What we're left with, because we can't screw with the HTML or tweak settings in the design, are social networks in which engagement rather than individuality is valued above all else. If you want to do truly creative, additive things, you may feel like you have to do them on other networks and simply mention them on Facebook or Twitter rather than letting that creativity happen on the platform itself," which I agree. And so like one way to do that is just to go to write a newsletter platform. But you have coded your entire newsletter. You've kind of MacGyvered it together, the entire structure, I believe, and set up yourself. So we'll go back to a bit of that customization bit in a second. But tell me more about like I get why you coded your own thing. So you could have full ownership and it becomes cheaper to access like the services on the back end to send emails, et cetera. But how much work went into that? Like how long did it take you and how much work does it take to like maintain something like that? I'm not a very technical person, so I just don't know.
I would say that one of the nice things about doing something like this is that when you build it, you know, for the most part, it stays in place. Like obviously you still need to like do your own upgrades and like do a little bit of maintenance here and there. But I think that when it comes down to it, I built out like a view for pulling in my newsletter issue so that when I publish, the issue will actually run, you know, will actually build like a full email newsletter version, like with the code already done. And I load up this view, and when I hit that page, like all that work is done for me. Whereas when I started, like, I think I used MailChimp very early on. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember the hard part of doing all this was that I had to deal with those templates, like those visual templates that were just like not set up for this. You know, I think a lot has improved since then, but mm-hmm. like, I was just like, you know, I just want to automate the thing so that I don't have to worry about it every 5 minutes, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, because a whole newsletter, like a designed newsletter, that's quite a bit of HTML, right?
Oh, yeah. I actually wrote an issue about this a while ago where I basically, when Casey Newton was still on Substack, he had an issue of platformer that I noticed like did a jump in HTML. And I'm just like, this is something that like I've worked really hard on avoiding, and he's just letting it do it. And my thought on the matter was basically, well, why is this? And so I like looked at the code of the issue, and I realized that the issue was not necessarily that what he was doing was like a really heavy code. Like Substack's newsletter wasn't super heavy code. It was that the links were just like massive. And because it was a newsletter that had links in it, like he used a lot of them. And so it was very fascinating to me how like, you know, this broken system that we've been using for like the last 30 years to send emails is like kind of kneecapping us from like trying to do stuff in the modern day. And I think that my solution has been, well, let's see what I can get away with.
Well, so I understand what you gain, right? And like the tweakability of every little bit. Is there anything that like you sacrifice, not by like not using any particular platform that like is more no code, but is there anything like in general you think you are sacrificing by like doing it DIY, or is it purely gain for you?
Well, you know, I've mentioned this before, and I think that like you know, I don't really have any qualms with mentioning it here, but like back in late 2017, I was reached out to by Substack when they literally had Bill Bishop, and that was it. And I think it was like Bill Bishop and one other person, and we're just like, come to Substack. And my thought was, well, I built this thing.
Yeah.
It's like I
your
have
baby.
I built this design. This is like the thing that I care about. The having the really nice looking email and telling me, oh, throw all that away for the chance to make money. Who yeah. wants that money? You know?
Okay. Moving on. I think so 4 years ago, you wrote that article I quoted from about like feeling limited on the web, right? Do you think, I don't think your view has changed because that's, I mean, it's like a pretty hard opinion, but do you think the web or like the platforms on the web have changed at all to like support more of that like individualism rather than, you know, engagement aggregation?
I think in a lot of ways, I mean, to be honest with you, I think depending on where you look, it may, you know, it may be a little worse, to be honest. I mean, I'm just thinking, for example, like, okay, LinkedIn, which is like, you know, it's, you know, let's call it what it is at this point. It's Tumblr for old people.
Yeah.
And, you know, and basically with that, like you're sort of encouraged into writing in this very specific shape, you know, where like it has to be a certain length mm-hmm. for the algorithm to pick it
Everything's
up.
Everything's one line.
Yep. And then like, you have to have an image. You can't link to anything in it or the algorithm's gonna just go nuts and like ignore you. And then you have to like mention it in a comment. It's just like you're basically shaping everything that you're creating to the exact parameters of an algorithm.
It's like literal, the medium is the message.
Yeah, that's absolutely what it is. And I think that, you know, I think that one of the things that I find really interesting is, you know, I don't think, you know, I think that I don't know how much of your audience is on Mastodon these days. You know, I imagine that like it, you know, it's seen as a pretty niche thing, like people who
I'm not tend on it. To use.
Yeah. But like I basically, when I saw that like the trend was like moving in that direction, I was actually already on it, but like I wasn't using it super heavy. Like when the trend seemed to be moving in that direction, I invested in it. I put time into it. And like, you know, I have like a pretty big follower base there and like they're super engaged. And that place doesn't have an algorithm. I can do whatever mm-hmm. I want if I really feel like it. And I think that like that's, you know, that's kind of what we've been losing in sort of the commercial social media space, you know, where we're like, everything kind of gets pushed in a certain direction and you're just kind of stuck with, you know, whatever they give you. And it's just like, yeah. you know, that totally goes against the idea of 2005, some 16-year-old accidentally figures out you can put CSS into your MySpace account and yeah. all of a sudden it leads to this explosion of creativity. Like that's
yeah, it's such a loss.
It is, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I think of that too. Like when I was, you know, 11 or something, I was like playing RuneScape, the MMORPG. And I was like, I mean, I had my MySpace. I was like, you know, designing the web thing. And then like RuneScape, I was like figuring out how to like make forum signatures and avatars in Photoshop and sell them for like in-game gold on online forums. And it was like all this like finding these forums where like I could like engage in that way. And I don't know, even, I mean, that's not like the exact same thing we're talking about, but just like the internet that was like 20 years ago that was so much more like it naturally led me into these things. And I feel like this is kind of a tangent, but I feel like now it's less about that and more about like kids figuring out how to like drop ship. It's more about monetization using these like no code things than it is about like creating things. Maybe I'm wrong. This is kind of just occurring to me as I say it, but like, do you agree that it's less about like making the thing creatively and more about like making money, period? I don't know. This is the theory I just made up.
you know, I think a lot about this, you know, because it's just like, I'll be straight up, like I think that like in a lot of ways, my approach probably leaves a bit of money on the table. Like that's, that's just me being straight up honest. And I'm sure it's totally different from what you usually get on a podcast like this.
Which is why I wanted to talk to you.
Yeah. But the thing is, like, I feel like, there's a certain integrity to kind of doing things, by the beat of your own drum and just hoping that this cool thing that you're building, has enough direction to it and has enough of a spark to it that like people will follow along with you.
And well, wait, so that, wait, speaking of LinkedIn, this is a kind of what you're saying a couple weeks ago. So you had this post, I just have this one quote from it. Content isn't software. It's not a machine to be optimized. That's kind of what you're saying, right?
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. There is a tendency to want to optimize content. I mean, there's this whole thing called search engine optimization, which is literally that.
Yeah.
But I think that like what ends up happening, very often is that this optimization, comes at the cost of the spirit of the thing that you're creating. It's always about like the keywords versus the voice. And I think that like my argument is essentially, okay, knowing that there is a sort of need to like hit the marks, so to say, to build reach on the internet, is there room to like still have the, the experience of creating, creating with the canvas and just hoping that like the cool thing that you make is seen as cool by other people. I think that you look at stuff like Patreon, for example, and that kind of experience is a piece of that, but like it's also like, at what point is it just like I'm getting into drawing so I can sell prints on Patreon,
Yeah.
So I think that there's like this tendency to want to create not for the art of it, but for the, but because they saw some YouTuber that like they really like and they figured out how to make money, like, taking apart a phone or
blowing not for the art up. Of it, but for the capital of it.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, yeah. So how many people, like, I don't need to hear the full story of how you've grown your subscriber base, but I think like part of it is just being around for so long, like TDM a decade. And then there's the 5 years of short form blog before that. I imagine some of those subscribers came there. So I guess what I'm getting at is like to be in, you're, if you choose to participate in like an Instagram, a TikTok, Substack, whatever, then you're being the Uber driver for posts where you're like beholden to the system, but maybe you're like accruing an audience quickly. But I feel like what you've done is like you stand outside that and you have accrued an audience, but it's been slower, partially because you've stood outside that, right?
Yeah. And one of the things I'll say is like the audience sometimes comes from other places. And I will say that like one of the things that like I've noticed recently is, okay, you said earlier I have around 12,000 subscribers. I think that's where I'm at right now. So I agree with you. But one of the things that I found recently is I have an RSS like service called FeedPress that I subscribe to that I use to sort of manage my feeds. And over there I have like 6,000, RSS readers, which is like, so basically 50% of the audience that I'm sending through email is like reading it through RSS.
Yeah.
And then I have a lot of web readers as well. I sort of am in this situation where like, okay, email is the thing that like I say that I do, but then I have this audience that like reads me not through email. And yeah. I think that like I've not been, I think that like I've sort of been pretty laissez-faire about it, like I'm not necessarily like, you have to subscribe to like read this. And I think
what matters is that people just care enough to read it.
Exactly. And I think that like that is a really good mindset to have with a lot of this, at least from my perspective. You know, you sort of lose out on the, exclusivity factor of it, But at the same time, it's like, okay, you know, if you want to do something that, like, you know, you care about, that, like, has the potential to drive a discussion that, like, you know, is outside of your little bubble, like, that seems like a great way to do it, you know? I guess if you'd like, I can mention my whole thing with Google over the last couple of months here.
Oh yeah. Well, so UDM 14, right?
Yeah. UDM 14. I had done this blog post, this newsletter issue. I call it blog post.
it's really interchangeable. I feel like newsletters are like what blogs were, which are what newsletters were, which are what paper newsletters were, which I want to get into that in a second too. You've written about that, but okay. Anyways, UDM 14, a blog post newsletter you did a couple months ago.
So basically, Google made this change to a search, and the search is, you know, infuriating because you're like, all of a sudden, the first thing you read is not like result from the website you actually want to go to, but the search thing that just tells you through AI. Mm-hmm. What Google thinks you were looking for. And I'm just like, oh man, this is awful. I need to get rid of this. So the first thing I did was I like looked at the URL structure and like found the tag that made it so you could go to this web mode that like removes like pretty much all knowledge panels, including mm-hmm. AI. So it's literally just the list of links.
It's just like the 10 and links per page, like Google used to back in the good old days.
Exactly. And so I find this thing, I write a post about it. The post starts going viral outside of my usual reach. And it's just like,
I think I read about it in like Neiman Lab or 404 Media's newsletter or something. That's how I found it.
Yeah. And so like I end up seeing how this thing is going, and I kind of make the realization like, okay, there's an audience of people that like they see this, but they're never going to want to do this because it requires them to go in the settings of their browser, and they're going to be too lazy to want to do it, but they hate the AI thing. Yeah. So I need to figure out a way to like very quickly get these people on the on-ramp to search without AI. So I put together this site called UDM 14. I threw the thing together in like an hour. I put it on a domain. UDM14.com was somehow open despite the fact it's a 5-character domain. And then I put it online, and within about 10 minutes, there's like 300 concurrent users. And it's like, it's 50,000 views in the first 24 hours.
Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah.
So how were people getting to it? Had you just updated the link in the blog, in your original blog post that then other people had been linking to, or how did that happen?
I basically just shared it on Mastodon, Blue Sky, and that site they call Twitter. And put it there. And surprisingly, of the three, Twitter was by far the most popular, and it like drove
people retweeting it and such. Yeah.
Yep, exactly. So it was a very traditional single serving site that like did its job. It served the single thing it was serving, and you know, it's been pretty consistently drawing like people in ever since.
Yeah. Okay. I want to talk about a couple of your other side projects. Specifically, I want to start with Midrange, which I think you did 2021 to 2023. The kind of subtitle was "Hot Takes in 30 Minutes or Less," which is a great joke already. But I think the conceit was you'd sit down, set a 30-minute timer, and write. And if you couldn't finish it in 30 minutes, you just wouldn't send it. Those are the details, right?
I basically would tell on myself if I passed the 30 minutes. So I basically would have to be like, I basically would have to like admit that like, oh no, I took 35 minutes for this one. And you know, like it put a little tension on me because it was just sort of like every morning I had to like hit this goal, and you know, like hopefully I could tell a good story in that period of time.
Were you doing this like concurrently with your day job? Like was this like one of like five things you would do every day, I imagine, right?
Yeah. Pretty much. I like at the time I had a full-time job. I was also doing TDM twice a week. And then the other 3 days I was doing this because, mm-hmm. you know, who needs a life, you know?
Yeah. Have you heard of the Japanese artist Own Kuwara?
I have not. Please tell me.
Yeah. So he's one of my favorite artists. And so this really reminded me of him. So he was like a minimalist artist. Like if you know that museum, Dia Beacon, just upstate New York, he has some work there. And he's most known for this series, The Date Paintings, where he did this for, I think, like 20, 30 years, where every day he would make a painting that was just like, there's like three different sizes. Most of them are like this big, like, I don't know, like 12 by 9 inches or something like that. But he would paint the date and it'd be in the format of the country where he was. So it'd be like, it could be like Jan dot date, whatever, the order, wherever that country was. And that's in white letters. And then the background is like a black, a blue, or a gray, or a red. And then he would make a box that he would store each one in that was lined with newspapers from that day, from that place. And if he didn't finish it that day, he would destroy it. So as soon as I read this, I was like, Ernie's just doing Own Kuwara date paintings, but as a newsletter. So that's crazy you hadn't heard of it, because it was just like, to me, it was the exact same concept. But yeah, so you should look him up. It's good stuff. But I think one of your last posts about from the Midrange series, again, I'm going to paraphrase here, but you wrote about the limits of rhythm with regards to creativity. Basically paraphrasing, you said that when you don't have a distinct deadline, i.e. finish this thing sometimes this month, it's really overwhelming, too much white space. But also when you have a consistent distinct deadline, i.e. spend 30 minutes every day trying to write this newsletter, that also suffocates you. I think neither one sufficiently reliably produces good creative work was the point. And I agree. I've experienced both of those things. Do you think there's actually a sweet spot for like creativity, for finding that creative rhythm, or is it just like, you know, that biological constant struggle for equilibrium?
You know, I think that like over the years I've tried different things. Like I've had lots of different weird formats. Like, you know, people who were subscribing to TDM in 2015 know that like they were getting a newsletter at 3 o'clock in the morning because I thought it was funny. You know, I think that, you know, I think that said, you know, in terms of trying to find like the perfect rhythm or the perfect schedule, like, you know, I think a lot about how, you know, things ended with short form blog, which was essentially that I had spent like all this time, literal years, like mm-hmm. writing 10 posts a morning, you know, before I like stepped into my day job.
Like every single day.
And these 10 posts were like very short. Like it was like literally it's in the name. And it was, you know, it was this rhythm that I caught myself in that like I found to work for a while, but eventually things started to shift and like I got older, you know, it was a little harder to stay up a little later. It was, you know, not as consistently, you know, possible to do. And I think that like when I started Midrange, I was sort of like, okay, I'm in this spirit where like I've gotten really flabby with my writing because mm-hmm. I like write really long pieces for a couple times a week. So yeah. Like, let's see if I can find that without like losing the spirit of the other thing.
Force gravity.
Exactly. And so I basically, you know, I think I found that the answer was, you know, ultimately trying to force yourself into a specific shape, it's good for a while, but then if you are too strict about it, it like leads you into a situation where like you're just like throwing stuff on the page because you need to throw
stuff on the
page.
Yep. Yeah. So you have a couple other side projects going on right now. And then, yeah, short form, TDM, Midrange, all these things. I was struck by the fact that, like, maybe it's just looking at, you know, all this stuff over the past 10, 15 years, but you are somebody who seems to know when to start projects and when to abandon them. And I think that's something that's hard, something I've struggled with, where it's like, okay, you can have a million ideas, but which one's actually worth starting? Or like, this thing, you know, you've been doing this thing in this one rhythm in this groove for however many years, and you're starting to feel burnt out. Like, how do you know when to stop? So, yeah, I guess first question, how do you know when it's time to abandon a project as somebody who seems to have done so quite healthily multiple times over the years?
I think that, you know, for me, you know, in terms of knowing when to stop, and I think in the case of Form Blog, I probably should have stopped that about a year before I actually did.
A year
not
before?
To say, yeah, not to say that, like, I didn't do good work in 2014, but it was just, like, a situation where, you know, it was very clear that, like, you know, life was changing. Things were stressful.
Yeah.
And I think that I was really in a spot where, like, I needed to, you know, I needed to take stock and, like, reassess. But what, you know, I think in the case of Midrange, it was very much a situation where, you know, I found myself, like, running into the same mousetrap, you know, where, like, because I was, like, in this position where I had written something every single day, like, inevitably it would, like, be the obvious thing. Like, it would be, and because we're talking about late 2022, early 2023, that obvious thing was Elon Musk buying Twitter. And it was just like, I think that, like, ultimately what this ended up turning into was I took the spirit of Midrange and moved it into the Tedium project, where I do a couple of shorter issues. I do not give myself a specific timeline where they need to be posted. I basically, you know, if I feel like writing at 10 o'clock at night on a Monday, I'm on it. If I feel like if I feel like writing at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a Thursday, you know, I guess you're getting an issue. I think that, like, you know, it's sort of a
Do you just write them and send them out? You don't, like, schedule them? I'm done writing. Time to send it.
Yeah, pretty much. I think that, like, I think that in some ways there's something really fascinating about having that kind of approach, because it's just like, this is blogging. Like, you want to embrace the rawness of the form, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the spontaneity. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, I think as well, like, just kind of getting to your point, like, there was one time that I'd actually tried to do something, a side project that was planned to be a side project. And I was going to
talk about Next Geist.
No, I was like, that was something I've tried a lot of things.
Yeah.
I've tried a lot of things over the years. And, like, you know, the thing that you just mentioned is what I said my next thing was for Midrange, which obviously I didn't do because
I couldn't find a trace.
but like, I'd actually built out a template, but then, like, I sort of realized, like, hey, you know, this is not where I'm at right now. And the thing I ended up actually building was a thing I called Lesser Tedium, which was a short version of Tedium that ran on Substack to, like, leverage the fact that they had just added, like, the social network, so I could, like, convince people to join the thing that was off Substack. And I did it for 3 months. I like made it very short. I made it very sweet. It was an experiment to see if, like, people would be more interested in short issues of Tedium rather than long issues. I found that the answer was no. The long issues are fine. And after 3 months exactly, I shut the thing down.
Yeah. Well, okay. So that brings up a good point, like, brevity in newsletters, because that's kind of one of the laws of newslettering, I feel like. And I mean, you, like I mentioned earlier, you'd written this article 2 years ago about the pre-digital newsletter history, and you pulled out like 9 lessons or points from this book this guy Howard Penn Hudson wrote, who this guy also back in the 80s was writing a newsletter called The Newsletter on Newsletters, which is everything new is old again, everything old is new again, whatever.
Yep.
Anyways, brevity was the name of the game, was one of the points that you included there. And you write a long newsletter. I also write a long newsletter. And it's obviously common sense, common knowledge that is not what you want to do. So I guess I think one thing there too is, like, with brevity doesn't just mean short. It means, like, condensed and, like, well edited. I think it does mean short, but I think that's part of it. So question is, when is it okay for newsletters to be long?
I think it's when the expectation is set that you can go long. You know, I think when people subscribe to TDM, I like say like
right it's very in clear.
We go long. I send a list to people, like telling people what they should expect from this thing that like is, you know, like because like you want to set expectations, but you know, I think at the same time, like you also want to be sure that like, you know, what you're doing is, you know, sustainable and fun and, you know, is creatively fulfilling. And I think that if you just switch up one day and decide that your short newsletter is going to be a very long newsletter, you know, that's a problem. But
you're gonna get some churn.
Yeah. But you know, if you kind of take this approach that like, okay, you know, I'm gonna do it this way. It's kind of anything goes. Like I'm going to intentionally make, you know, write subject lines that are obtuse so you don't know exactly what you're getting until you click the thing in the email. Like it forces you to like, you know, not lean necessarily in lean in a bit, except that like this guy's gonna take you somewhere. You know, and that somewhere may just be like a 3,000-word piece about, you know, how the safety button works on your jar of salsa, which, you know, is an issue I actually wrote at some point, you know?
Yeah, I believe it. Okay, the creator economy and this concept I've been hearing more about, the taste economy, right? They both kind of exist within the larger attention economy, let's say. And this is on my mind because somebody on Twitter the other day had made some point about like, they're like, why isn't anybody building the tool for distribution? You know, and I'd replied, I was like, I don't think you can solve that. Like if there's a tool that solves for distribution, it's defeated itself because if you want distribution, if you want to solve for distribution, go text your friend. That's the solve for distribution, one distribution. But like the one to many distribution, I'm skeptical that it can be solved. Basically my reply was some version of that. And then this guy said, I don't think it's a zero sum game. I disagree. I think it is a zero sum game. I'm curious to hear what you think, because I think like, let's say with newsletters, right? Like, which are only one, like there's only so much attention anybody can give any type of media in their day to day. And let's say with newsletters specifically, I think it's like, if you're writing an English language newsletter, your market is people who speak the English language, who are online, who have an email account. And more specifically, they're probably somebody who has to use email for work. Otherwise, you're probably not checking it that much. And then those people, on average, probably have enough time for one newsletter a day. So I guess the question is like, do you think it is a zero-sum game or not? In the attention economy.
I think one thing that I have a couple of thoughts about this.
Yeah.
One, to kind of touch on the point that you were making about like whether distribution is a nut that can be cracked. I would recommend taking a good look right now at at what was happening around ActivityPub. It's a it's a distribution.
Fediverse, right?
Yeah, Fediverse distribution mechanism. There's some work that's being done on this front. I will admit it's by Ghost, you know, that like, you know, is definitely worth keeping an eye on, because it's sort of working on this specific kind of problem in terms of like making it so that when somebody posts something, it gets distributed, you can follow people, you know, that are distributing in this method. It's very interesting to see what's going on with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, does it solve the problem? I'm hopeful that like maybe it does something, but you know, we've seen a lot of this before. On that point.
Before we move on to the next point, I think that's kind of my thing though, is that like any new platform or new solution does solve it, but within a matter of months to years, people find a way to dominate that with whatever marketing techniques, and then it becomes they kind of crowd out the other people who don't have the time or money to like spend on like, you know, pushing out volume or like whatever on that channel. So it's like, that's kind of my, where I was landing is like, you can solve for it, but only for a short period of time with a new platform. And maybe you're right with like ActivityPub. That's, I need to look more into it. It's like something I keep hearing about, but I haven't looked into.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that, you know, that's a fair point. And you know, one thing that I'll say in that, in the decade that I've been doing this, like almost a full decade, is that there's just been a tendency to, you know, as more people get into this, like they get better at, they get better at different things than you're good at. Like, okay, yeah. I got into this as a writer and journalist and creative person who wanted to like write and journalist and create. And I run a newsletter group.
Yes.
And it's called Newsletter Nerds. It's on Facebook. It's not really super active these days because Facebook is
one post in the past month.
I've done pretty much research. You've done your research. Good job. But there was a point where like somebody tried to post like some growth hacking scheme on it, and it was very, very aggressive and very obvious what they were trying to do. Somebody pretty well known in the newsletter space actually, and I blocked the person, and then somebody else that they knew posted it again, and it was just like, oh, so like what's ultimately happening here is like people who are really good at growth
and shitification
are going to start crowding out people that are, you know, are just trying to do this because they enjoy doing it. And
yeah,
I'm not necessarily saying that that's everybody. I'm not necessarily like trying to name names or like criticize anybody about it. I just think that like that zero sum game point that you're getting to, you know, that is the version of it that I think that I've seen in this space of the last decade. And I'm sort of this guy like waving the tiny little flag for just being creative and trying to do it in a way that like isn't about like results over all else. But that said, it would be nice if I had a couple more people in my corner on that front, you know, like I know that they're out there. I've talked to plenty of them. It's always good to get a couple more.
Well, so no, so this is great. I think like one of my other, you know, theories of what is a creator is that like they're all, there's it's a Venn diagram, right? And there's like so a creator, to be successful as a creator online, it's a mix of the creative skills and the business skills or the marketing skills. And I think like you, the way you're describing yourself is very much in the creative skills bucket, right? But I think when it becomes more crowded, these things, and more people are doing like growth hacky stuff, whatever, you, like somebody like you, maybe who's just starting out, who like the version of you who's like launched Tedium today, right? Like you are then forced to like either learn some of those more marketing business skills or partner with somebody who has. And I think like both of these things have become oversaturated, but then it goes back to what we were talking about earlier with like the kid who's trying to make money instead of make the thing for art's sake, right? So I think like more people maybe get interested in purely the monetization side rather than the creative side. And maybe it's a thing where like that continues happening until there's a you know, just kind of a crash for a course correction, because like there's not enough quality, and then the quality kind of just starts rising to the top because like it's just so like there's so much low quality stuff. I don't know, that which is kind of just an obvious, I think, kind of, you know, it's the pendulum swings and the pendulum swings back kind of thing, but I don't know.
Yeah, you know, I think so much of that is really true. You know, like I think that, you know, when I started doing this, it was like, you know, there are a couple of newsletters that I still know are very active that like were around back then, but they're they're very small parts of the overall pie. Like, a lot of those people, like, from that era are still kind of around, but it's tough, like, when you're getting into it, like, it's sort of like people who start, like, a YouTube channel now to talk about video games. There are so many YouTube channels about video games that, like, it's impossible to stand out unless, like, you hit all the levers. You, like, talk about, like, the very busiest and busy things. You have a lot of money to throw at the problem. And, you know, you're willing to, like, take other creators down in the process. Yes. We haven't gotten to the take other creators down part in the newsletter.
The hostile takeovers, as it were.
Yeah. But I do think that, like, we're sort of in the situation where there's so many people that, like, want to get into the space that maybe aren't starting with the same motivations that I did, you know, or or, you know, people who started in 2015 or 2016 or even 2017 did. And I think that that's not necessarily healthy for this space.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I understand it because, you know, like you said, it's, you know, it's sort of a situation where, you know, as things become more saturated, like, you know, the sponge can only hold so much.
Yeah, exactly. So what is one thing that you're very optimistic about in the newsletter world and one thing you're pessimistic about?
I think in terms of what I'm optimistic about, I think I'm optimistic that, you know, there'll be creators like that come, you know, that come after me, that come after, you know, what we currently have that are doing really embedded things that, like, will keep pushing the space forward, where it won't necessarily just be, like, you know, the same three types of newsletters for everything, where it will be, like, something that, like, you know, builds and creates, like, another form of the medium. Like, I think that, like, there's plenty of room to do that because we have better tools than we did in 2015 when I started. You know, like, you know, fact of matter, like, the fact that there's, you know, there's so many options to send a newsletter now, you know, Beehive being one of them. I think that is, you know, it's really, you know, it really opens up the space to a lot of different types of creators. I think the thing that I'm pessimistic about is, you know, there's always the risk of, like, you know, the trend chasers that you sort of see online, like, exploiting what is a good thing for a lot of people in the community for sort of their own personal sake, which is not to say that, like, I'm necessarily criticizing anybody for that. I'm just more, like, thinking about, okay, well, you know, there was a lot of...
Well, it sounds like you're saying the same thing for both. The good thing and the bad thing are both the higher level of access.
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of that. You know, like, the thing is, there is a higher level of access. It, like, makes it so that it democratizes it. But then there's also the situation where, because there's more democracy and because it's easier to, like, build the thing, like, it leads to people that are, like, well, you know, subscribe to my Web3 newsletter, you know, and like, they just build up the biggest list. And, like, once the next thing shows up, like, they move that list to the AI newsletter, you know, like, it's
lack of integrity.
I think that that's sort of it. And, you know, I realize that, like, you know, it's not really a great, you know, great creative growth storyline to be like, you know, knock that off. But, you know, I think at the same time, though, like, there is a need to, like, keep in mind that integrity does matter in this space, because people need to know that, like, the people that they read, you know, they do understand that, like, this is not just, like, you know, this is not just, like, a game for them. Like, they want to ensure that, like, you know, it's, you know, if they're getting a quality product and it's, you know, like, they're not just, you know, they're not being thrown under the bus for the sake of like an easy buck, you know?
Yeah, no, that's good. I agree with that. I think integrity is something that gets thrown under the bus itself a lot.
Yeah.
Okay. Last question then is like, what's on your mind for the next, you know, couple of years, year or two? You're about to hit a decade come January. TDM will then have survived twice as long as short form blog. Do you have like, you know, ambitious new project plans, or are you kind of just, you're happy where you're at and you're continuing apace?
You know, I think that like one thing that I'm kind of thinking about, and I'm not necessarily saying that like I have anything like firmly set in plans, but I think that like a lot of the strategy that I've learned over the last decade, like I would like to be able to take that to, you know, to like a more niche approach, like basically, you know, try to target a more niche audience that like it makes sense for, you know, and maybe do more of the monetization stuff for that to like make it like, you know, a viable thing that doesn't have to like, you know, lean on, you know, random viralness or, you know,
like, yeah,
luck of the draw.
Is it as a business, is it like sustaining itself plus a little bit right now, or is it like, are you breaking even on your time? Do you feel, is it sustainable for you right now? Is the question, I guess.
I mean, I think it's, you know, I would say that it's breaking even in terms of like I make a profit off of it, and it's, you know, like I think that like it's not like the main thing. Is that like the main thing that I do? Like I have a freelance journalism career, and yeah, in many ways it's like a great inroad to like,
it's a calling card, you know, it's a business card.
It's a great calling card to be like, you know, hey, I've done this thing that's been featured all these places, and you know, like I've had a lot of success with it, you know. But I think at the same time, like I'm not trying to like turn it into this like, you know, $10 million business. I'm just trying to like make it something that like is a successful thing creatively.
You're not trying to build a media empire. You're just trying to sustain a column on the newsletter internet.
Exactly. And that's, you know, maybe that doesn't make me ambitious enough. Maybe it makes me like a bit old school, but whatever. You know, it's,
well, I think for most people, that's the move, honestly. Like I was talking to Kate Lindsay from Embedded a couple weeks ago. And she, just kind of the same for her. She was very upfront. She was like, look, I'll tell you, I make $1,500 to $3,000 a month through subscription revenue, but it's like, this is more about something that is consistent. And then I have my freelance journalism career. I think the more I think about, like, I'm interested in this idea of the newsletter internet and everybody being a columnist on it, whether or not you're like doing it fully independently as you are, whether or not you're like paying for software to do it, whether that's Beehive or Ghost or MailChimp, or if it's Substack, and Substack is like, I feel like with Substack, it's like, it's fully a media company where they just, you know, they take a cut. Anyways, my point being, I think it's good to be a columnist on the newsletter internet, which just sounds, yeah, like what you're doing.
I think that's very much what I'm trying to do. And I think the other thing that I'll say though, is like, you know, one thing I think a lot about, you know, kind of going back to, you know, the forebears of this industry, you know, Mr. Howard Penn Hudson, one of the things that I found really interesting about, you know, reading his book and then doing research on him was, while he was clearly writing for a different medium, like his, you know, his thought process around it is very similar to what you see today. You know, like it's, you know, a lot of, you know, find the right niche, you know, mm-hmm, try to engage those people, like build a model, build things that like support that model, you know. And I think that like, I love, you know, I kind of like the idea that like, okay, I built this thing that is just like sort of amorphous and weird and fun. But I also think that like, it would also be interesting at some point to build something that's tightly focused, yeah, and does, you know, does specific storytelling that is beneficial to know, a very narrow and specific audience. I think that that like is something I'd like to look into at some point. I'm not saying it's going to be like, you know, I have a launch coming in a month.
It's not your Q3 goal. Yeah.
It's not my Q3 goal, but I think that like, but I think if I do that, I don't want to like just do it like with, you know, with the random newsletter. I want to like put the same mindset I've put into TDM, that being like the willingness to like do the work to build up to that versus just trying to build this thing that's like, I started an account, like I now have a newsletter, you know, like there has to be more strategy to it than that, you know?
Yeah. Planning, a real editorial point of view. Yeah. Cool. Well, I think that's a great place to end it. Where should people go to find you and your work?
Find me at tdm.co. I've been doing it for a long time. I have a lot of side projects I'm sure you've heard, but that said, the place where you're going to find me mostly is TDM.
That's the place to go. All right. This has been the Creator Spotlight Podcast. Ernie Smith has been our guest today, and I have been your host, Francis Asir. I will see you next week.